Which gets us back to the cause of death. While the blow to the head was certainly forceful enough to have caused death, the coroner's report only speaks of it as an associated cause. The specific cause, as we've noted, is listed as asphyxia by strangulation. And with good reason. The most reasonable scenario under which the victim would not suffer massive head bleeding would be that her heart was no longer pumping, or pumping only faintly. In other words, she'd already been garroted. The petechial hemorrhages under the eyelids are consistent with this finding. Now, if that was the case, how can we work in an accidental, sudden, rage-provoked injury on Patsy's part? You can suddenly lash out and hit someone with your hand or fist, though the evidence is not good that this is what happened, but you don't accidentally garrote your child, or anyone else, to death. That is very much an intentional act, and to my knowledge, no one has suggested that this mother did that to this child. Okay, then, maybe John did it. Maybe this ligature was part of some horribly perverse sex game. My esteemed colleague Roy Hazelwood has done a lot of research on autoerotic asphyxiation and why it so often ends in death. The scenario would have John choking his daughter to the point of passing out, then reviving her, all the while performing some kind of sex act on her. Possible? Physically, yes. But again, not one iota, not one scintilla of evidence suggests he practiced or was capable of this kind of behavior, and an overwhelming amount of evidence suggests he was not. People do not act in a vacuum. Every action is tied to every other action. John Ramsey is not and was not a sex offender and has none of the characteristics. Another problem with this scenario is, if John killed JonBenet, then even if the death was accidental, the sexual abuse that accompanied it would not be. Under this circumstance, John could not have counted on his wife to stand by him. Yes, maybe if she were particularly crazy, she might have perceived a sexually abused child as a rival and been satisfied that she was eliminated. Maybe she would have considered that John was her ticket to the good life, so no matter what she thought of his actions, she had to stand by him. But those are pretty bizarre possibilities for people who gave no indication of any aberration of this nature. And a reasonable, calculating executive such as John would have known he couldn't count on his wife not to give him up, especially over time. I almost feel as if I am dignifying John Ramsey's accusers by going over this. But we have to make very, very clear that he could not have done this to his daughter. So if we go back to our made-up scene, we see that no part of it makes any sense. I said we would get back to the issue of motive. Let's look at a possible scenario suggested by Detective Steve Thomas in his book, JonBenet, Inside the Ramsey Murder Investigation. I'm not going to present it in the level of detail that Thomas does, but I want to represent it accurately because, though he and I disagree, I believe we're both after the same thing. Thomas believes there was already tension between Patsy and JonBenet on Christmas Day, based on the child's willfully refusing to wear the dress her mother had selected for her. After dinner at the Whites, the Ramseys came home and before long put the two children to bed. Patsy was frazzled with the hecticness of the holidays and preparations for the trip to Michigan, which Thomas says she did not want to make. Thomas speculates that JonBenet wet the bed and woke up. The red turtleneck shirt found balled up in the bathroom must have been what she wore to bed. Then Patsy stripped it off her when it became wet and redressed her in the clothing in which she was found. The detective goes on to say, I never believed the child was sexually abused for the gratification of the offender, but that the vaginal trauma was some sort of corporal punishment. The dark fibers found in her pubic region could have come from the violent wiping of a wet child. I have to say here that I find this part of the theory particularly bizarre. The abrasions around and on the inner wall of the child's vagina certainly seem to be the result of some form of digital sexual penetration, but the suggestion that they actually resulted from Patsy forcefully wiping her there brutally enough to do that is hard to imagine. In any event, Thomas then postulates some sort of explosive encounter in the child's bathroom, in which JonBenet was slammed against a hard surface. At that point, Patsy was overtaken by panic at what she'd done, quickly decided she couldn't risk the emergency room route, so she moved her daughter's body down to the basement room. She then went back upstairs to the kitchen and wrote the ransom note from her own tablet to make the crime appear to be a kidnapping. After that, she returned to the basement and realized that though JonBenet was mortally wounded, she wasn't actually dead. Thomas allows for the possibility that JonBenet was already dead at this point, and that Patsy realized it. In her desperation, Patsy seized the closest items available to her, the handle from the paintbrush in her painting box, and a length of cord, with which she fashioned a garrote around the child's neck and tied her wrists in front of her. For the next several hours, she fine-tuned the staging, placing the three-page note where it was later found, and putting a piece of duct tape over JonBenet's mouth. The rest of the roll and the remainder of the cord were either deposited in a neighbor's trash can, or perhaps down a nearby storm sewer. Then she discovered the note, screamed, alerted her husband, and set the events of the morning into motion. When Officer Rick French responded to the 911 call shortly before 6 a.m., Patsy was still wearing the outfit she'd had on the evening before. She'd never gone to bed. Evidently, she'd been too busy. Thomas speculates that John Ramsey first grew suspicious while reading the ransom note, more so when no kidnapper called, and probably found JonBenet's body on his own sometime during the morning when Detective Arndt noticed him missing. Then John faced his own dilemma, whether to give up his wife or stand by her. JonBenet was gone, and he'd already lost another beloved daughter. If he turned on Patsy, the family would effectively be destroyed. So he became part of the cover-up and used Arndt's suggestion that he and Fleet White look through the house as an opportunity to officially find the body. And the Ramseys have stood together, hidden behind their lawyers, and stonewalled the police ever since. I have trouble with this scenario on many levels, all of them based on my 2.5 decades studying violent crime, particularly the behavioral aspects. First, if Patsy took such time to set up the scene to make it look like something other than what it was, why didn't she do the one truly obvious and mandatory thing, make it look as if someone had broken in and then left again? If you're going to go to all the trouble of writing a ransom note and staging the body, how do you forget to make it look like a break-in? The Ramseys actually said they thought they'd locked all the doors. Okay, maybe Patsy was panicked and not thinking clearly. But it defies logic that she would think of all these arcane, sadistic things to establish credibility, then not do something so simple. Possible, but highly unlikely. The same is true with the legal pad that the ransom note came from. If Patsy wrote the note herself, she knew where the paper came from. She knew it would be evidence. She knew it would help tie her to the crime. And she's going to leave it out in plain sight? Totally illogical. If you're going to do that, you're going to leave the duct tape roll and the cord out in plain sight, too. If you dispose of one, you dispose of all of them. Thomas believes that when John carried JonBenet's body upstairs, he had already previously discovered it. Having seen John's reaction when he was describing finding the body to me, I am certain that his reaction was genuine. I also believe that if either John or Patsy knew that JonBenet's body was in the house, they'd be itching to get the ordeal over with rather than let it drag on for hours. One of them would have innocently said, "Has anyone checked the basement? Has anyone looked downstairs? Or, I thought I heard some noise downstairs." I also think the condition in which the body was found suggests Patsy wasn't the perpetrator. Many commentators have mentioned JonBenet's being wrapped in the blanket and cited my frequent observation that parents or others with proprietary interest in the victim will leave her in some kind of loving or protected state. In his book, Steve Thomas went so far as to state, "John Douglas was almost denying his own writings in order to give the Ramseys a pass." Well, I can't help it if readers, particularly law enforcement professionals, misunderstand or misinterpret what I say, or only look at the surface material. This is a problem I run into again and again. It's as if there is a profiling 101 course that can easily be applied to fit every case. Unfortunately, that's not the way it is. It's not easy to become an experienced profiler, and even if you get to that stage, all profilers are not created equal. In this case, if Thomas had ever asked me about this detail, I would have been happy to clarify it for him. For one thing, the body was not protectively wrapped as I would expect to find in a parental murder. It was haphazardly draped, with the arms and feet sticking out. In all probability, the intruder intended to use the blanket to carry JonBenet out of the house. This is in no way similar to the almost hermetic wrapping or sealing I have often seen. But much more to the point, I cannot conceive that a loving mother with a profound proprietary interest in the victim could possibly insert her fingers into her little girl's vagina to punish her, let alone make it look as if an intruder had molested her, and then stage her dead 6-year-old's body with a garrote tightly around her neck. If that were the case, we would have seen profound evidence of psychopathology from Patsy by now, and we have not. As with Beth's death and her own cancer, not to mention a prostate cancer scare with John, this woman has experienced precipitating stressors in her life. Then there is the issue of motive, the one we deferred a little earlier because this is the most fruitful context in which to discuss it. To react in a certain way requires precursive behavior. As mentioned previously, we are told that JonBenet had a chronic problem with bedwetting, to the point that Patsy had a morning washing routine for dealing with it. So why would one more incident make her snap? With the excitement of Christmas, the late nights and parties, preparing to go away and generally being off schedule, if anything, a mother would expect it to be more likely for an accident to occur and would take it in stride. It's not enough to suggest that she was tense because of the upcoming trip. That's not enough of a reason. It's not enough to make Patsy say something to the effect of, "JonBenet, you've wet your bed 582 times already, and I'm not going to take it any longer," then slam her across the room. Mothers don't suddenly act that way. No one does. And, of course, a bedwetting confrontation would much more likely occur in the morning than the middle of the night. You have to jump through too many of those hoops to make it work. This goes as well for the other possible motive some have suggested, that JonBenet suddenly wanted out of the pageant world and Patsy couldn't deal with that. This is another scenario you have to jump through hoops to achieve. All indications are that JonBenet loved performing, in fact, pushed her parents to let her do more. The family had enjoyed a happy day, and even coming up with such a notion at bedtime when all she was thinking about was going to Michigan and then on the Disney boat would have been completely out of context. And it is not the kind of thing that would have come up in the middle of the night. If it did, JonBenet would have to have gone up to her parents' bedroom and made her announcement, thereby involving John as well as Patsy, which means that one person couldn't have flown off the handle without the other intervening. And if such a mother-daughter confrontation had occurred at bedtime, both John and Burke would have heard it. It doesn't work. When my unit consulted on a potential domestic case, or when I was teaching criminal investigative analysis at Quantico, or for any other police agency, I used to stress that it is absolutely critical to look closely at what was going on in and around the victim's family in the days or weeks before the crime. The 1996 Christmas season was a happy time for the Ramsey family. They loved Christmas anyway, particularly the excitement of the kids, and this was one of the best times of their lives. John's company had topped $1 billion in annual sales. Patsy had recovered from a terrifying and deadly cancer. The children were happy. JonBenet charmed everyone, and she and Patsy loved going to the pageants together, despite whatever judgments any of us might have about their value. The family was looking forward to the vacation in Michigan, and then the cruise on the Disney ship. Now, fast forward several hours to this beautiful little girl, strangled to death with a garrote, bashed in the side of her head, tied up, and left in the basement wine cellar. How do you get from point A to point B? One of the first things we look for in profiling is a precipitating stressor, something that made the offender act or react the way he did. We don't have any here. There's nothing going on. No matter how badly JonBenet messed the bed, if she did at all, the urine stains in her panties and long johns could easily have come about when her bladder tension released at death. I don't believe that Patsy would suddenly lose every instinct and inhibition she'd ever had and strike out violently at the being she clearly loved as much as anyone else in the entire world. And God knows she wouldn't strangle her daughter to death. It just doesn't happen that way. There would have to have been some previous behavior to suggest this was possible. And there simply was not. I mentioned that when I first met Patsy, she was wearing a large cross around her neck. I've often seen people accused of crimes suddenly get religion, and I was wondering if the stress of what she was undergoing had occasioned this necklace. But then, when I had the opportunity to examine many of the Ramsey family snapshots, I saw that she had been wearing this same cross for several years. I learned it had been given to her by her minister during her cancer treatments. I saw nothing to imply to me that her religious faith and her belief in her miraculous salvation from cancer were anything but genuine. And I have trouble believing that she could have been so cynical as to assert that her baby's killer would get his just deserts from God, even if he eluded temporal justice, if she were the killer. This is not to say that I have been taken in or influenced one way or another by her religiousness. I am only pointing out a belief structure on her part that seemed to be internally consistent. Lou Smith's scenario. I was not alone in my analysis. In March 1997, Alex Hunter hired a retired El Paso County Sheriff's Department homicide detective named Lou Smith to conduct an investigation on behalf of the DA's office. El Paso County is due south of Denver and encompasses Colorado Springs and the U.S. Air Force Academy. Smith, a gentle and soft-spoken man in his 60s, had acquired legendary status in Colorado as a brilliant investigator with an astounding 90% clearance rate on more than 200 homicides. In his wallet, he kept a plastic photo folder with pictures of some of the victims for whom he'd obtained justice. Smith's legend was solidified with his working of the 1991 murder of Heather Dawn Church, a little girl who was killed in her house near Colorado Springs. The case went nowhere for 4 years, with the prevailing attitude being that someone in the family had done it, and the police were not aggressively seeking other potential suspects. With dogged determination and an obsessive attention to detail, Smith found a print at the scene that had pretty much been overlooked. He was able to match it to a suspect who was subsequently arrested in Florida. Smith had pulled the proverbial rabbit out of the hat. Shortly after Smith came on the Ramsey case, he examined all the evidence and, unlike the Boulder PD, concluded that, as in the Heather Church case, an intruder had killed JonBenet. He believed that a pedophile who had seen JonBenet in public decided to go after her that night and broke into the house while the Ramseys were celebrating with the Whites. The offender probably went in through the grate and window well to the basement, then explored the entire house. He used Patsy's pad and pen to write the ransom note. Then, before the family returned home, he hid and waited for them. Once he was convinced they were all asleep, he went into JonBenet's bedroom and immobilized her with a stun gun applied twice directly to her skin. He taped over her mouth with duct tape he had brought in with him and carried her unconscious down to the basement, where he could remove her from the house without disturbing the parents on the third floor. He found Patsy's paint box and broke off the brush handle to fashion into a garrote with the cord he'd brought. As he choked the child as part of his erotic fantasy, he simultaneously penetrated her with his fingers. The unidentified DNA under JonBenet's nails and in her underpants, the unidentified pubic hair, the unidentified palm print on the door, a high-tech brand boot print on the floor, and the scuff mark on the wall below the window all came from the unsub, according to Smith's theory. The fingernail deposits occurred when JonBenet awakened and tried to fight him off. That was when he panicked and struck her hard in the head, possibly with a flashlight. Believing he'd killed her, he left the body and escaped from the house, taking with him the articles he'd brought in, the cord, the duct tape, and the stun gun. Smith also had an interesting alternative theory to the $118,000 figure. If the intruder was planning to flee to Mexico, at the exchange rate in effect at the time, $118,000 would have yielded 1,000,000 pesos. After he left the DA's office, Smith went through his presentation on the case for me. I didn't necessarily agree with all of his interpretations, But his overall approach made a lot of sense, much more than the twisted logic of the bedwetting scenario. Many of the other investigators, including, according to Steve Thomas, some from Quantico, objected to Smith's assertion that an intruder would be bold enough to break in and then hang around a house full of sleeping people. But there is much precedent for this. You can be fearless or mission-oriented without being particularly criminally sophisticated. The stun gun theory. Lou Smith pursued the Ramsey investigation with every bit of the dedicated meticulousness with which he had worked the Church case and all the others. His theory took shape when, studying the photographs of JonBenet's body, he noticed two sets of small red welts on her skin. Each set was the same, with the two marks in the same relationship to each other. He thought it highly unlikely that two such regular marks could be coincidental. He pursued this with several people, eventually ending up with Michael Doberson, the coroner of Arapahoe County, Colorado. Doberson had worked on a case involving a stun gun. After studying the photographs Smith showed him, he said that they did seem to be consistent with a stun gun, but he couldn't say for sure without examining the body itself. Smith pursued the stun gun possibility and narrowed down the type of weapon that could have produced the telltale marks to an air taser brand. According to Steve Thomas, the police discounted the possibility of a stun gun being used in the crime, but I do not know why. I am not an expert on such weaponry, but when Smith showed me his evidence, it looked compelling to me. Like the attic floorboard and the Lindbergh kidnapping, this is one of those elements upon which the entire case can hinge. If, in fact, a stun gun was used by the offender, that would virtually rule out the parents by itself, in my view. A stun gun could be used on a 6-year-old child with only two possible intentions in mind: to torture her for sexual pleasure or to immobilize her. Neither of these fits into any reasonable scenario involving the Ramseys. The presence of a stun gun would show planning and intent, not accident. If the marks on JonBenet's body did come from a stun gun, and it would be unlikely to have two sets that so match up to an air taser that did not, it is interesting to note that while the notepad and the possible headblow weapon were in plain view in the house, the items intended to control, the duct tape, the cord, and the possible stun gun, were not found, suggesting the offender probably brought them with him. This is also probably true of the flashlight, which would be another natural implement for an intruder to bring. When he found he needed a blunt force weapon, then, he had it right there. The ransom note. Few would disagree that the 3-page ransom note is as important a piece of evidence as exists in this case. Anyone hoping to come up with a theory of who killed JonBenet Ramsey has to come to grips with the significance and meaning of this communication. When I saw the note, how long and bizarre it was, my first thought was that, regardless of who wrote it, it had to have been written before the killing, not afterward. No one, family member or intruder, would have had the presence of mind, the mental concentration, to sit down in the house and write this out with the body lying there in the basement. For this reason, I don't believe the note was part of a staging in the same way that the police and some members of the FBI seem to believe. This does not mean I think monetary gain was necessarily the prime motivator in the case, although it could have been. It just means that the note was written deliberately, not as a hasty cover-up after the fact. With very few exceptions, the spelling is correct and the syntax consistent, leading me to believe the note was written by an educated individual. Compare this to the Lindbergh communications or the Jack the Ripper from Hell note. But it is so strange, and the amount of the ransom demand is so small relative to Ramsey's wealth and what we would expect an extortionist to ask for, that we can rule out sophisticated or professional criminals. If this is a criminal enterprise homicide, it was perpetrated by an amateur. For the sake of convenience, I will use the masculine pronoun in this analysis. To begin with, the phrase, "listen carefully," implies an offender unsure of himself who therefore feels the need to secure attention. Using the plural "we" lends him more strength and credence, as does the suggestion that they are foreign terrorists with a political agenda. However, the silliness and awkwardness of the sentences We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We represent your business, but not the country that it serves. Gives him away. What occurs to me is the construction of a teenager or young adult who watches a lot of movies. I can imagine a movie character saying, "They represent a small foreign faction." Even the phrase, "At this time we have your daughter in our possession," is awkward and unsophisticated. And interestingly, though there are repeated references throughout the note to your daughter, she is never mentioned by name. Is it possible the writer of the note did not know her name, or, even more likely, did not know how to spell it? On the second page, the writer says, "Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial." This also speaks to the writer's insecurity, and I don't believe a mother would refer to her daughter's death as an execution. In the same way that Patsy wouldn't physically abuse the body, I don't believe she would talk about withholding the remains. This would be too painful for the mother to countenance. Anyone trying to make up a ransom note as staging would write something as short and to the point as possible. You'd be careful not to give any unnecessary clues. I find it equally interesting that the note instructs Ramsey to withdraw $118,000 from your account. It doesn't merely demand the money, it gives specific instructions, as if the writer knew that this precise amount of money was available in the account. I therefore think it likely that the writer had been in the house before and seen some documentation, possibly a pay stub, that this amount had been deposited in John Ramsey's account. To a young adult, this might have seemed like a lot of money and a good amount to ask for. Many have suggested that the $118,000 figure was such an inside piece of information that the note had to have been written by one of the Ramseys. I must admit I don't get this at all. If one or both of the Ramseys were using this note to stage an apparent kidnapping, why would they purposely point the finger at themselves by using inside information? If John Ramsey knew he wasn't going to have to pay the ransom anyway, why not ask for $5 million and make it look more legitimate? The only scenario that might make some logical sense in which one of the Ramseys came up with the figure would be if Patsy wanted to stick it to John through the note, that is, if she were trying to give him a message. This could also account for such phrases as, "You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John, and use that good southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John." But if that were the case, Patsy would have found ways to continue revealing herself and sticking it to John after the fact, and she did not. In fact, the police were monitoring all of their interactions with each other that first day at the Fernie's house, and there was no evidence of her trying to get back at him or punish him in any way. To me, the $118,000 figure points away from the Ramseys, but toward someone who knew them or had observed personal details of their lives. There are quite a few movie references in the note. "You and your family are under constant scrutiny as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John." Corresponds to, "You know that I'm on top of you. Do not attempt to grow a brain," lines delivered by the Dennis Hopper extortionist character in Speed, which was out on video at the time of the murder. "Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded," corresponds to, "Do not involve the police or the FBI. If you do, I will kill him," from Ransom. "If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies." Sounds like, "If I even think you're being followed, the girl dies," and, "That's the end of the game, the girl dies," from the Clint Eastwood hit, Dirty Harry. The phrases, "Now listen to me carefully," and "Now listen, listen very carefully," also come from Dirty Harry, as does, "It sounds like you had a good rest, you'll need it." Compare that to the notes, "The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested." That's a lot of very similar material to be merely coincidental, and it is difficult to conceive of Patsy sitting alone in the kitchen writing out a fake ransom note after she's killed her daughter and coming up with all these movie phrases. If Patsy could recall any movie lines, they'd likely either be favorites from her childhood or current children's movies. Even John would not know the kinds of references found in the note. To me, that sounds more like the conception of a teenager or young adult. So does the phrase, "We are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics." So does, "Will result in your daughter being beheaded." Who uses words like beheaded these days? People who play Dungeons and Dragons-type games and watch Hercules or Xena Warrior Princess on television, I should think. I was told that beheadings were a key element of the Highlander TV series. The point is, I can't be certain from the note who wrote it and who killed JonBenet, but from the psycholinguistic analysis, it does not appear to have been written by a 40-year-old woman panic-stricken over having just accidentally killed her daughter. The transcript of Patsy's 911 call is also instructive here. Toward the end of the conversation, the dispatcher asks, "Does it say who took her?" At first, Patsy doesn't understand the question, and it has to be repeated. Finally, she says, "It says SBTC, Victory. Please." If she had written the note herself, I think she would have answered with something like, "No, it doesn't say, but someone's got my baby." Instead, I visualize her leafing through the note looking for the answer to the question. The only thing she can find is what is written at the end, so she mentions SBTC, which in itself doesn't really answer the question, so she moves one line up to Victory, which also doesn't help. But this strikes me as someone who is unfamiliar with the note and desperate to find out who has taken her daughter. What does SBTC mean? Who knows? We've heard everything from Saved by the Cross to Santa Barbara Tennis Club. One of the early interpretations was Subic Bay Training Center, since John Ramsey had served at Subic Bay in the Philippines while in the service. The problem with that one is that there was no such training center there. I have often found when interviewing violent offenders after they've been convicted and incarcerated that they come up with obscure references that mean something only to them. This was certainly the case with the interlocking circles and punched holes in the Lindbergh notes. With respect to the Ramsey ransom note, an inevitable question arises. If this really was a kidnapping or an attempt to extort money or get back at John Ramsey for some reason, why wouldn't the offender bring the note with him rather than count on being able to write it at the house? I don't know. I can suggest several possibilities. He was disorganized enough that he forgot the note at home or didn't think about it until he got there. He didn't want to risk leaving a note on his own paper for fear of being linked. He had enough time alone in the house to write a better one than the one he brought with him or intended to send after taking the child, and he wanted to implicate the Ramseys by tying the note to them. But these are only possibilities. There are almost always aspects of a case you can't work out, such as the absence of fingerprints in the Lindbergh nursery, or why the Ripper used a different weapon in the first killing on the night of the double event, or the odd costume the Zodiac wore at Lake Berryessa. But I don't have an explanation I'm completely satisfied with. A lot of information has come out about how the experts have not been able to rule out Patsy Ramsey as the writer of the note. While this is apparently true, it is misleading, like so much of the reporting of this case. At least four highly reputable handwriting experts were called both by the police and the defense, probably a lot more, and the consensus was that while Patsy's handwriting could not be ruled out, the similarities were at the very lowest end of the spectrum. In other words, many, many people would qualify or fail to be ruled out under this criterion. From a behavioral perspective, I have to question whether, if Patsy had written the note, she would have so willingly submitted to so many handwriting tests and given up so many previous handwriting exemplars. Even if she were purposely trying to disguise her penmanship, handwriting analysis was a field she knew nothing about, so would she have believed she could fool the experts, particularly with 3 pages of evidence? One of the most interesting analyses of the ransom note came from Vassar literature professor Donald Foster, who has made quite a reputation for himself as a literary sleuth. He stunned the academic world by proving through textual analysis that a 578-line poem he had found on microfilm in the archives of the UCLA library had actually been written by William Shakespeare. This was the first discovery of a previously unknown Shakespearean work in 112 years. Using a similar technique, comparing the work to known examples of the author's writings, he unmasked Newsweek columnist Joe Klein as the anonymous author of the best-selling political novel Primary Colors. In 1998, Foster announced he had determined that Patsy Ramsey had written the ransom note, which sounded pretty compelling coming from such an established expert, and Steve Thomas has written that he placed great weight on Foster's analysis. But then it came out that in the spring of 1997, he had written to Patsy Ramsey at the Charlevoix, Michigan house to offer his condolences, encouragement, and the statement, "I know you are innocent. Know it absolutely and unequivocally. I will stake my professional reputation on it." He had also stated that he believed John Ramsey's son, John Andrew, had been posting on the internet under the code name Jameson, and that this Jameson was the actual killer. When it turned out that Jameson was in fact not a 20-year-old male college student named John Andrew Ramsey, but a 45-year-old North Carolina housewife named Susan Bennett, who had merely developed a tremendous fascination with the case, Foster's analyses with regard to the Ramsey case were severely called into question. The fact is, no one has or will come by the whole truth from a single clue or piece of evidence. Post-offense behavior. A significant aspect of the consulting services we provided at Quantico was to describe an unsub's expected pre- and post-offense behavior. In this way, it might be possible for someone who recognizes this behavior to come forward and aid the investigation. Likewise, we can use analysis of pre- and post-offense behavior to help rule out suspects. We've already talked about the behavior of the Ramseys leading up to JonBenet's murder. Now let's look briefly at their behavior afterward. One of the greatest raps against them is that they didn't behave like people who were innocently bereaved. One component of this was their supposed emotional reaction to their daughter's death, and I think we have effectively dealt with that. Another is the fact that they lawyered up right afterward, though saying they did not cooperate with the police is another entire area of misleading reporting. We have shown how they did answer all police questions on the day of the discovery of JonBenet's body. We have shown how they agreed to give all the physical and handwriting samples they were asked for. And it is well documented that their attorneys made numerous offers to have them speak with the police, but the two sides could never get together over the rules until June of 1998, when they submitted to 3 days of interviews. One reason for the Ramseys' attitude toward the police was the police's attitude toward them, and this can be explained whether they are innocent or guilty. As I travel around the country giving presentations, one of the laments I hear over and over again from members of victims' rights groups is that the police were not forthcoming with information, did not keep them in the loop, did not make them part of the search for the killer of their loved one. Some departments are sensitive on this issue, and some are not. But the problem is certainly compounded if the cops come in with the attitude that the bereaved are also the criminals. Once the Ramseys realized the police were holding up turning over their daughter's body for burial, until the Ramseys agreed to the interrogation under the conditions the police dictated, they realized they were in an adversarial relationship with the investigators and had to protect themselves. I don't find this behaviorally indicative of guilt. More to the point, both John and Patsy spoke regularly with law enforcement officials they trusted. In the first several weeks, Patsy communicated repeatedly with Linda Arndt. They both communicated with members of the district attorney's staff, and once he came onto the case, they communicated regularly with Lou Smith. They cooperated with the people they trusted. This is totally consistent behavior. They also allowed me to fly to Atlanta at my own expense. I had long since stopped being paid on this case at my own request, and talked to them extensively over a 3-day period in March 1999. There were no ground rules and no lawyers present. Did they agree to speak with Smith and me because we believed they were innocent? Sure. But they also knew that each of us had been roundly criticized for our opinions and for being taken in by this couple. And they were smart enough to know that Smit and I would each jump at the chance to solve the case, and who the perpetrator was would be immaterial. We would give either of them up in a heartbeat if we could show he or she had killed their daughter. Did they think they were so clever that they could go mano a mano with either of us and not slip up? That shows incredible arrogance, or incredible criminal sophistication. And here lies the crux of the post-offense behavioral issue. My analysis is that though there were organized and planned elements, this crime was basically criminally unsophisticated in its conception and perpetration. If the Ramseys were involved, then their post-offense behavior has been criminally sophisticated in the extreme. They are both master criminals and sociopaths who sprang full-blown into that position without any preparation or practice. They were so confident that they felt they could take on their accuser, such as Steve Thomas, on live national television, Larry King Live, CNN, May 31st, 2000, where one slip-up would give them away. If John thought Patsy had done it and that she was mentally unbalanced, would he let her out of his sight? Would he let her make numerous trips on her own without fear she would inadvertently spill the beans and sink them both? Most important, would he let her continue to care for his son? If they both thought their son Burke knew or suspected anything, or had ever overheard them saying one word about having been involved in JonBenet's death, would they let him go off to school on his own, let alone sending him off to the Whites the very morning after the crime? Who would trust a 10-year-old never to say anything he knew? Not me, and I've had three of them. Most people have been looking at the surface behavior, but not thinking about the truly indicative stuff. The grand jury. Moving into 1998, little demonstrable progress was being made on the case. Trying to move forward, Boulder PD had been lobbying for a grand jury investigation, figuring that such an entity could compel testimony that they could not. On March 22nd, a grand jury of four women and eight men was impaneled. It began its work on September 15th. By that time, though the case had not progressed, there was a major development on the personnel front. On August 6th, Steve Thomas submitted a letter of resignation to Chief Beckner, complaining about the handling of the investigation by the police and the interference by the DA's office in not charging the Ramseys. He doubted that justice would ever be done for JonBenet. On September 20th, Lou Smit submitted his own letter of resignation to District Attorney Hunter, stating, "I cannot in good conscience be a part of the persecution of innocent people. It would be highly improper and unethical for me to stay when I so strongly believe this." The second anniversary of the murder came and went without any suspects being identified. John Ramsey had lost his job with Access Graphics. He believed it was because he was perceived as a corporate liability because of all the negative publicity. He was probably right. On March 19, 1999, Detective Linda Arndt resigned from the department. To me, this represented just one more example of an investigation in disarray. Arndt described how she had looked into John Ramsey's eyes and knew what had happened. The inference most people drew from her statement was that John was the killer. Steve Thomas, having access to the same evidence that Arndt had available, concluded that Patsy had been the killer and that John wasn't involved until the cover-up. The grand jury's term was scheduled to expire on April 21, 1999, but on April 7th, it was extended for another 6 months because its work was far from complete. I testified before the grand jury on April 26th and 27th, 1999. Since their proceedings are secret, I'm not at liberty to reveal what I said, but some in the press have speculated that my testimony and Lou Smith's created serious doubts in the grand jury's mind. I don't know if this is true, and I don't know what Smit testified. I only know I told them what I believed, and I'm sure he did the same. Prior to my testimony, Detective Sergeant Tom Wickman, who was now heading up the investigation for Boulder PD, introduced himself and told me he'd read all of my books and particularly admired the Crime Classification Manual. He thanked me for the work I'd done in the area of criminal profiling and what he considered its significant contribution to law enforcement. I was very appreciative of all of Wickman's comments. On October 13, 1999, Alex Hunter and the grand jury announced that it had found insufficient evidence to indict anyone in the JonBenet Ramsey case. Some speculated that the final decision might have been Hunter's because under Colorado law, both the grand jury foreman and the district attorney must sign a true bill of indictment for it to take effect. Steve Thomas condemned Hunter for not indicting the Ramseys and letting a jury decide the truth. Attorney and Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz declared Hunter a constitutional hero for taking all the barbs and not bringing a case to trial that he did not feel could be supported. This was just one more example of the huge and seemingly unbridgeable divisions this case has engendered. Loose ends. There is no way to be exhaustive on a case of this scope, and anyone who studies it will have his own crucial element or piece of evidence. I've tried to present what I consider to be the important points, but items are always left over in any discussion, and we'll try to deal with some of them here. 1. If there was an intruder, why didn't his footprints show up in the snow around the house? This is another of those greatly misreported facts. Contrary to what was originally reported, only a light dusting of snow was on the ground on the night in question, plus the walk had been shoveled. So even if the intruder had left through the window well, he would not necessarily have left tracks. 2. How would an intruder get in? Smith believed he got in through the window well to the basement. This may well be the case. It is also possible that he gained access by using a key. At least 20 keys to the house were floating around that were not in the Ramseys' possession. If the offender was someone who knew them well, or knew someone who had worked for them or had a key through some other legitimate reason, this is a likely possibility. It is also possible that one or more doors had been left unlocked. This was a low-crime area, and the Ramseys sometimes did leave doors unlocked when they were not at home. This was also true of ground-floor windows. During a search on the morning of December 26th, a police officer reportedly found the door on the south side of the house unlocked. 3. If neither of the Ramseys killed JonBenet, and the real killer is still out there, why hasn't he been caught, and why hasn't there been any evidence of his subsequent work? First of all, this was not the work of a serial killer. This is not someone who killed for the fulfillment and satisfaction of exerting manipulation, domination, and control over a victim of opportunity. This was an inexperienced, mission-oriented offender. So there is no particular reason to believe he would repeat the same signature crime over and over. And it is unfortunately true that many homicides go unsolved, particularly in jurisdictions without a lot of experience working them. On December 21, 1997, almost exactly a year after JonBenet's murder, Susanna Chase, a University of Colorado student, was murdered in downtown Boulder. Like the Ramsey murder, Boulder PD has been unable to solve this one. Where is that killer? 4. If JonBenet's body was discovered on December 26, 1996, but the Ramseys chose to mark the date of death on her tombstone as December 25th, doesn't that imply specific knowledge that only the killer would have? That's apparently what the police believed. Having dealt with many bereaved families of murder victims, I think the use of this date as a clue is ridiculous. Parents will always search for some meaning or significance out of the tragedy of their child's death. Christmas Day had a happy and symbolic significance to the Ramseys. If they didn't actually know whether JonBenet died before or after midnight, it was perfectly natural that they would choose the date that had the most meaning to them. On one level, I believe choosing this date was an attempt to remind people of the presence of evil in the midst of innocence and joy. 5. Would an intruder risk this much time in the house? Certain types of intruders would. In 1988, my unit worked a kidnapping case in Jackson, Mississippi. On July 26th, Annie Laurie Herron, 72 years of age, in poor health, and the wife of Robert M. Herron, one of the state's wealthiest men, was abducted from their elegant Georgian home in a well-to-do neighborhood in broad daylight. Only about an hour window of opportunity existed between the time Mrs. Herron's brunch guests left at 3:30 p.m. and her husband returned home at 4:30. Nothing in Annie Herron's background or lifestyle suggested her as a target, yet the unsub was willing to go to great risk to get to her. Clearly, this was not a victim of opportunity. There was a ransom note, as bizarre in its way as the Ramsey note. It was typed on an old typewriter and referenced School Pictures, a company that Robert Herron had controlled, although it was only a small part of his holdings. The note also listed 12 individuals who had been franchise owners of the company and directed Herron to put these people back in the shape they was in before they got mixed up with School Pictures. So the unsub was someone who felt he and School Pictures had been wronged by Robert Herron. Bill Hagmeier, who by the time of the Ramsey case headed up CASKU, the FBI's Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit, the successor to my Investigative Support Unit, took on the profile of the unsub and put in his usual first-rate effort. As I recall from our case consultation discussions, he defined Mrs. Herron as a symbolic victim and the offender as mission-oriented, with a strong commitment, even though the crime was crudely planned and somewhat impulsive and high risk. He believed the residence was probably surveilled ahead of time and that the unsub had most likely been inside before, either through legitimate or illegitimate means. Despite the ransom note, Hagmeier believed the motive was primarily anger rather than material gain. Working from the profile, the ransom note, and such leads as the fact that a white van with Florida plates had been observed on several occasions near the crime scene, investigators identified a prime suspect. Newton Alfred Wynne, one of the individuals listed in the ransom note, lived in Florida and was losing virtually everything he had as the result of a lawsuit over School Pictures. At Wynne's home, police found a typewriter that appeared to be linked to the note and a map of Jackson, with the Herron's neighborhood circled. Wynne was convicted of extortion, conspiracy to kidnap, and perjury, and sentenced to 19 years. But like the Ramsey case, this one continues to haunt me. Annie Laurie Herron was never found, and no one has ever been charged with her murder. Her husband Robert died 2 years after her disappearance of a heart attack. But there are enough similarities between the two cases, particularly in the astuteness of Bill's profile, to open our minds to the possibilities in the Ramsey case. Summing up. Actually, there is no way to sum up a case like this. I don't claim to know who did it. I only think I have a pretty good idea who didn't do it, and that is what I've tried to present. Having said that, though, it would be ducking the issue if I did not at least present a theory of what might have happened. The behavioral evidence I have discerned, and the forensic evidence I have seen and read, plus what has been conveyed to me by Lou Smith, lead me to believe that JonBenet Ramsey's killer was a white male, relatively young, who had a personal grudge against John Ramsey and intended to carry it out by defiling and robbing him of the most valuable thing in the world to him. I believe he entered the house while the family was out, either through the basement window well or with a key, bringing with him a stun gun, a roll of duct tape, and a spool of cord. His intention was to incapacitate JonBenet, abduct her, and molest her. This was a personal cause crime rather than a criminal enterprise. The ransom consideration was secondary and may not even have occurred to the unsub until he was in the house. This could account for the notes being written on Patsy's pad, and this could account for the $118,000 figure. That is, he had no real intention of collecting so low of sum. He was just trying to make a point. Or maybe he brought a briefer ransom note with him, but when he had the time, he altered his plan and wrote a note on the Ramsey's own paper that was lying out on the counter, getting out more of his anger and resentment. How bad or insulting would this look for the Ramseys? The high risk for the intruder would have been mitigated by the complexity of the physical layout of the house. He could have hidden out in the basement, which he would have illuminated with the flashlight he brought, getting familiar with the warren of rooms. The unsub stole up to JonBenet's bedroom after her parents were upstairs asleep, incapacitated her with an air taser stun gun, which would not make a loud noise when fired, taped her mouth, and carried her down to the basement, which he had already checked out, and where he used Patsy's paintbrush handle and his own cord to form a garrote around the child's neck. He also bound her hands tightly. Whether he intended to or not, his tightening of the neck ligature either killed her or nearly did so. When he realized what he had done, he panicked and finished off the job with a blow to her head. Then, instead of removing her from the house, he fled in panic. This is only one possibility. Another would be that this actually was an intended kidnapping, planned by one or more teens or young adults who had been inside the Ramsey house and had seen John's pay stubs. Maybe they were friends of one of JonBenet's babysitters, workmen, or friends of friends. That's just a guess. But to a teen, $118,000 would be a lot of money. He would also be so unsophisticated as to have no idea how difficult it is to pull off a kidnapping, even the kidnapping of a 6-year-old girl. He would be bold and foolhardy enough to enter the house and wait there, during which time he could have written the ransom note he forgot to bring with him. In this case, both the stun gun and the garrote may have been instruments of control rather than torture. The digital penetration of the child's vagina would have represented the young man's casual sexual experimentation while he had the opportunity. This type of behavior would not be rare. Again, when he realized he had killed or nearly killed his victim, he would have panicked and fled. Normally, a teen or group of teens will fold like a house of cards when confronted by investigators. But if the heat was never on him because of the focus on the Ramseys, he may have been able to slide under the radar. The fact remains, I'm not sure who killed JonBenet Ramsey, and the fact that her killer has not been found and charged represents a terrible injustice. That injustice will only be compounded if the wrong people are accused. I always said that having a child murdered was the worst possible thing that could happen to a person. I guess I was wrong. Having that happen, and then being blamed for it, is even worse. Chapter 7. Perspectives. In examining the themes these cases share to figure out what continues to haunt us about them, one idea that comes to mind is that of archetype or icon. From lurking evil to the inner workings of family, from celebrity and its implications to the mystical and arcane, from sexual obsession to the corruption of innocence, each of these cases, as we've seen, represents an archetype we can all understand. Each of these cases represents the dark side of something potent and elemental. That's why they're fascinating. But they're also important and instructive, because while they give us a window onto the human condition, these cases also show us what can happen when we're not prepared to deal with them. Each of these cases suffered from serious investigative difficulties, errors, irregularities, or other problems. In the Whitechapel murders, the investigators didn't yet understand what they were dealing with. In the Borden slayings, they were hamstrung by societal stereotypes about women and class. In the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, well-meaning and sympathetic officials lost control and let the connection to the kidnapper slip away from them. In the Christine Schultz and JonBenet Ramsey murders, the crime scenes and evidence were compromised from the get-go, and the investigations stymied by departments with questionable agendas. With the Boston Strangler, a confession provided a simple, quick solution that ultimately proved unsatisfying and unconvincing. These cases are also representative of much larger issues in crime-solving and criminal justice. So what can be done? Several things, I think. We've made a lot of progress in the century plus that this book spans, and as we've said, we think we could help solve some of these cases that haunt us if they were presented to us today. We have techniques, abilities, and understanding we didn't have back then, whether we are talking about the 1880s or the 1980s. DNA analysis, medical examination, computers, preservation of evidence, laser enhancement, modern psychology, profiling, interview techniques, threat assessment, and other fundamentals of investigation are just a few of these. And yet, even as you read this, several thousand unidentified dead are lying in the nation's morgues. In 1960, the clearance rate for homicide was around 91%. Now, due to factors such as proliferation of stranger murders, that is, offenders and victims unknown to one another, it's around 65%. Unless we actually use what we've got and learn how to consistently manage investigations in a uniform and competent way, all of the modern developments and improvements are going to be meaningless. If you have excellent techniques for hair and fiber analysis but adulterate the crime scene before the evidence team arrives, you've got nothing. If you can identify murder weapons from bullet markings but don't determine who was in possession of the weapon, you've got nothing. If DNA evidence can determine which specific individual in the entire world was at a scene, but your chain of custody is called into question, you've got nothing. We could go on and on with examples. I speak all over the country on criminology and related subjects. When I address and meet with victims groups, people always come up to me and describe absolutely heinous crimes that I've never heard of. And if I haven't, who else has outside the immediate circle of those affected? With such serial killers as John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Joel Rifkin, the dead had piled up before authorities even knew there was a problem. There are not only more violent crimes than there used to be, but increasingly they're committed by strangers, someone who doesn't know and has no personal grudge against the victim of opportunity. And that kind of homicide gives us big problems. The point is, we've got to use what we've got better and more efficiently than we're doing now. In 1985, I attended a ribbon-cutting ceremony at Quantico for the FBI's new VICAP, the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. Attorney General William French Smith and Bureau Director William Webster attended. VICAP is a computer database listing in-depth particulars of predatory crimes. It was intended that when one of the more than 17,000 law enforcement agencies in this country had a violent, predatory case, a potential serial murder or rape, for example, the case would be entered into the computer by filling out a carefully constructed questionnaire, and then VICAP would be able to provide them with the experience of anyone else in the country who had similar evidence or clues. It was a tremendous idea, coming originally from former LAPD homicide detective Pierce Brooks. But while the profiling program quickly got on its feet and established itself, VICAP faltered and stumbled. By the time I retired from the Bureau in 1995, only a few thousand cases had been entered. The local agencies just didn't want to go through the trouble, particularly if not everyone else was doing it. Meanwhile, the Canadians have studied our system, instituted their own, and run with it. The difference? Participation by Canadian forces is mandated. Anyone who doesn't use it risks losing government funding. It does no good to have a sophisticated national resource like this unless everyone participates. As anyone who's read Marx and my recent novel Broken Wings knows, for a long time I've been advocating the creation of a flying squad. This would be a team of specialists in all areas of criminal investigation. Detectives, profilers, medical examiners, crime scene technicians, ballistics, hair, fiber, and blood spatter experts, forensic anthropologists and entomologists, whatever is needed, who could quickly get to a major crime scene anywhere in the United States in their own well-equipped plane and work the case while it is still fresh and uncorrupted. They wouldn't all have to be Bureau people either. I would make it like the military's Delta Force, taking the best people from whichever agency or service could provide them. I also advocate the establishment of an independent national laboratory for processing evidence, separate from the FBI and other federal agencies, whose scientists would be the best and whose reports would be reliable and unassailable. One of the issues we've seen in some of our haunting cases is that we really don't know whose facts or whose evidence to believe. For example, was Rail 16 a legitimate piece of the Lindbergh kidnapping ladder, or was it planted by overeager police officers? Was Elizabeth Short cut in two while she was still alive, or after death? This lab could go a long way toward restoring the credibility of evidence in criminal investigations and prosecutions. In the meantime, states can do some things on their own. A lot of times a local police department's or prosecutor's office chief problem is that it can't or won't communicate, either with the victims of a crime, the public in general, or other departments. I think this could be greatly ameliorated if each state would set up a major crimes task force. Some have already done so, and the results have been impressive. Such a group would hold regular meetings with representatives of individual police and sheriff's departments and state investigative and lab facilities. They'd hear formal presentations on various aspects of forensic science and discuss both hot and cold cases. The critical consideration is that each official, detective, or investigator anywhere in the state would know what resources were available and how they could be used. This would avoid a Ramsey-type situation in that a local department without necessary resources or experience would have both the means and, just as important, the self-assurance to quickly call on the best help available. While the FBI hasn't enjoyed the success I would have liked to see on VICAP, a major, nearly incalculable contribution has been made with the National Academy program. Chiefs, division heads, and senior officers and detectives of local and regional agencies are brought to Quantico for intensive training, orientation, and familiarity with the latest trends and techniques of law enforcement. Not only does the National Academy give its graduate fellows a deeper understanding and wider perspective, it also creates an informal network of people around the country and the world who know each other and can call on each other when the need arises. Some of my greatest successes have come about because the local officials who called in my unit had become familiar with us through participation in the National Academy. The 1985 investigation of the Sherry Faye Smith and Deborah Mae Helmick murders in South Carolina, I alluded to in the previous chapter, were examples of what can happen when profiling and related services are married to superior local police work to catch a serial killer before he can go any further in his devastation. And I've often said that one of the key reasons for this was because the two outstanding officers in charge, Sheriff Jim Metz and Undersheriff Lou McCarty, were both National Academy graduates. Metz understood that by calling us in, he was not displaying weakness or uncertainty, but strength and commitment to putting together the best team he could to protect his community. And for that reason, he, McCarty, Rochester Police Captain Lynn Johnson, and so many others like them, will always be heroes and role models in my book. There are other lessons and commonalities in these cases that I hope come through. Borden, Bimbenick, and Ramsey demonstrate that you don't just wake up one morning and decide to become a murderer. There is always some predictive behavior. If there isn't, or you can't find it, then you've really got to wonder about your suspect. And the Boston Strangler case shows that a criminal can't suddenly and for no reason change his personality. The Ripper, Zodiac, Dahlia, and Ramsey cases all teach us that there is no such thing as a motiveless crime. It just means you don't fully understand it. Lindbergh, Borden, and Ramsey, particularly Ramsey, can warn us of the danger of jumping to a conclusion without knowing or understanding critical facts because of preconceived notions. If we do, we play right into the hands of the tabloid and sensationalistic media and are no better than they are. In the Ramsey case, even the mainstream media came under their influence to the detriment of all, except the person who got away with murder. If there is a feeding frenzy to be the first, truth is the likely casualty, as we saw in the unfair accusations against security guard Richard Jewell in the Atlanta Olympic Park bombing case, a perfect example of the perversion of profiling by people who didn't really understand what it was all about. Conventional wisdom is often based on mythology, and each time and place is going to have its own set of standards. Lizzie Borden couldn't have killed her parents because that's not the way well-off, well-brought-up ladies behave. It must have been someone like Bruno Hauptmann who killed Lucky Lindy's baby, because a true American wouldn't have done that. Bambi Bimbenick must have killed Christine Schultz because she was an aggressive, conniving second wife. The Ramseys must be responsible for their daughter's death, or else they would have cooperated with the police. These are not statements of truth or fact. They are myths of conventional wisdom. And finally, I think of these cases like statues on a war memorial, a few specific images that represent all of the thousands upon thousands of soldiers who cannot be named, but who gave and suffered just as much. 2 weeks after JonBenet Ramsey's murder, a 9-year-old child known only as Girl X to protect her identity and privacy was beaten, raped, poisoned, and left for dead in a corridor of Chicago's notorious Cabrini-Green public housing project. She was found by a janitor with her own T-shirt tied around her neck and gang symbols scrawled on her body. She wasn't a child beauty queen, and she didn't come from a prominent or wealthy family. But she suffered unspeakably, and she and her family deserved not only our sympathy, but our attention and outrage, just as every victim does. The same year that JonBenet died, 804 children aged 12 and under were murdered in the United States, according to the FBI's 1996 Uniform Crime Report. Yet there is only one name among them that we know. I don't want to take anything from the enormity of what happened to JonBenet. I only want the same emotions extended to all the others. Like those fallen soldiers, there are thousands upon thousands of cases that you will never hear about, that will never be given sufficient attention or resources to be solved. And those cases haunt me just as much. This concludes the reading of The Cases That Haunt Us, from Jack the Ripper to JonBenet Ramsey. The FBI's legendary mind hunter sheds light on the mysteries that won't go away. By John Douglas and Mark Olshaker. Copyright 2000 by Mindhunters Incorporated. This book was read by Malcolm Hilgartner. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Scribner, a division of Simon & Schuster Incorporated, and was produced in 2016 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.